Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Podcasts Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Liskov.
And I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your normal host, Pat Satanic Host, better known as the host of the show Hell of Misfortune. What a great pun that was.
What a great
puns.
This movie had some good puns. The thing that, first and foremost, with us today, is Lewis Peitzman.
I thought we could just keep talking about puns before.
I keep trying to like introduce like just like 7 minutes of chat before we introduce the guest, because I just, you know, I'm not interested in formality. But you know what? It's a special guest.
It is a special guest. Lewis, you reached out to me on Twitter and you were like, you know, love to come on the podcast.
I threw myself at you to be on the podcast.
No. Here's the thing. I threw myself at you to come on our podcast for 1999. So it feels like it's now sort of reciprocal. You came on 99 to talk about everyone's favorite film, Stigmata, from 1999.
Yeah, it's certainly a fave of mine.
And so when you reached out, I was like, obviously, love to have you on. And you picked two movies, one of which I never heard of, which is Mom and Dad Save the World. Is that the name of it? Or something like that?
Yes, that is the name of the other movie that I mentioned.
The other movie?
Mom and Dad Save the World. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. I've never heard of this movie. But Lewis picked that and this, which seemed to have similarities.
They were just my two childhood favorites.
Sure.
There are a handful of other movies that were not released in 92 that were childhood favorites. Right. But those were the two that I like remember renting constantly. And I didn't really think of a connection, except that Joel on Twitter said that he thinks of them as being paired. So clearly,
well, they are parents forward movies, right? Like they are like very sort of parents saving the world, for lack of a better way of putting it. And they do feel very, and this is sort of a broader thing that I want to unpack, obviously, the course of this episode, in terms of like where this fits in terms of like early 90s comedies, like kind of hangover from the 80s into the early 90s. Like you don't see many movies moving forward where parents are the protagonists. Like it doesn't happen very often. Like adults start to become the supporting characters shortly.
I feel like I can tell you exactly what this is. That's my baby. I don't know if you can hear my baby, but that's my baby. These movies are a response to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Huge hit.
Yes.
They follow that template exactly. Like this is just Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in every particular.
But Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, I don't disagree with you, Emily, but I also think that the kids had more, like, they were the heroes of that movie, right? Like, we were following the kids.
I would argue that that their aunt friend was the real hero of the movie. And
you mean
kids
auntie?
Yes, the kids happened to also be there. No, but I think there is something about, like, the adults being central. The kids, I mean, the kids in Stay Tuned, definitely, one of them at least does something. I mean...
Yes. These yeah, kids here, are not, like, yeah.
I was thinking about it in terms of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, in that it flips the script. Now the kids are in the Rick Moranis role from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but it is the same thing of, like, popular teenage girl, younger bratty brother, who's also a science genius. Like, those they could have just cast the kids from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids and been fine, but the kids from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids are currently in Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, another
which
movie.
Which we will be covering.
Another movie I wanted to see in 1992 and did not get to see in 1992.
You know, it is interesting. This movie, which, as I said to you, Lewis, before we got on, Mike, I'd never seen before. Emily, this was a movie you wanted to see quite desperately in 92. And we're not allowed.
I'm just going to put it out there. I'm just going to put this energy out there. I was a Stan Dauber. I was all in on Pam. And I just, like, I have been saying this around the apartment. I've been, like, excited to watch this. And Libby's been like, why? And I'm like, well, you know, I love Pam Dauber. And she's like, this is a bit. And I'm like, no, it's not. I love Pam Dauber. And you've listened to me on this show. You know, everything I do seems like a bit, but also seems sincere. This tilts a little more towards sincere than a bit, but it is both.
I mean, I think that one thing that I didn't realize when I was a kid is that Pam Dauber and John Ritter are both so attractive. This is a movie where the parents are very hot.
Yes.
And I think that should be acknowledged, even if it was underappreciated by me as a 6-year-old when this came out. I don't know when I first saw it. I was definitely not six, but right. I was pretty young. Didn't get how hot they were.
I mentioned this, Emily, when we were doing the throw to this episode in the previous episode that we recorded.
what was the episode before this one?
I believe it was Patriot Games.
what a double feature.
And I worked in video stores, throughout high school and film school, and obviously went to video stores as a kid. And the box art on those video cassettes were very arresting, intentionally so, right? They were always, like, trying to pull you in. And I don't know if you had this when you were a kid, Lewis, but there are some that haunted me, some that stayed with me, and then I felt like, oh, I don't think I want to see that one just based on, like, box art. And Stay Tuned was one of those, because there's something very sort of haunting about these parents shackled to these chairs with this, like, weird kind of Wheel of Fortune wheel behind them. And I think it looks like a classic sort of 80s hand-drawn artistry. Like, it was kind of powerful.
Well, what haunts me about that image is there's a golden retriever on the that's looking and, like, looking in the screen and up on the TV that is nowhere to be found in the film.
Yeah. If it was the Rottweiler.
They digitally removed him after he was credibly accused of sexual harassment.
but Jeffrey Jones was not removed.
No, Jones.
Well, Jeffrey Jones' crimes came to light long after, but the Golden Retriever's crimes were, like, revealed between production and post-production. So, of course, they were like, we got to get that dog out of here.
The effects in this movie are surprisingly good. So I do believe they could have removed the dog, and now believe they did.
Well, there's also something very satisfying about the end of this film when someone says to Jeffrey Jones, you're canceled.
Yes, I did have that in my notes as being a nice moment of clarity.
Full circle.
Someone, like, predicted this. They knew it would age really well.
Yeah.
And they said good for them.
Do you think Mephistopheles could write, like, a column for Barry Weiss's newsletter, like, about his cancellation?
So when I was a kid,
this is,
I mean, I know we're, like, getting ahead of whatever order you want to do this in, but I was going to say that this is sort of my first, experience with a Faustian bargain narrative.
Sure.
So that when I read Dr. Faustus in college, I was like, oh, it's like Stay Tuned. but watching it this time, I was like, I don't think they mention him as a Mephistopheles figure, but he's not actually Mephistopheles, and his name isn't Spike. That's his last name. He's like something Spike. I forget his first name. So I think he, is he just like a guy? They seem to like hire random people to work at Hellvision. I guess they're dead, but I really want to know more about like how you get a job there, and is there? It seems like there's like a there's room for like upward mobility, and there's
no
a lot
absolutely.
Of,
it is interesting that it sounds like you think this movie might be muddy in terms of some of its intentions.
No, not at all. I think it's the clearest. I think that the plot and the themes
Swiss Watch
are very well articulated. And you know, it's all in the last scene with the fencing. It's all, you get the whole point of it, which is that fencing is really what we should be focusing on.
So I think Americans watch too much television. That's kind of a subtle theme that's in the background of this film.
You know, what's interesting is that as I was watching this film, and Emily, you're married. So I'm curious, Lewis, I don't know if you're married. So
I'm not
okay.
Married.
As a married person, Emily, I wanted to sort of unpack the themes of this movie. Seem to be about mm-hmm. a couple trying to find their way back to each other mm-hmm. through television.
Mm-hmm.
So TV can save a marriage?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, the thing that my wife gets mad at me for taking up too much of my time is podcasting. So like, I think that what we need to do is Libby and I need to find each other through podcasting. Yeah. So we're going to just see how
podcast?
We'll figure that out. Yeah. actually, my very first podcast, TV on the Internet, which is no longer available. Don't go looking for it. We took it off because it's terrible. But like, that was launched when our marriage was at its lowest ebb, and we credited it with saving our marriage. And it was kind of true. Yeah. So you can save a marriage through podcasting is what I'm saying. You can also save a marriage through getting sucked into a television hell.
Well,
that was my bigger question, which is that it does feel like this movie is trying to have its cake and eat it too, right? Which is like, mm-hmm. TV's bad, but is it? Like, it's a little, you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Well, I kind of thought they were going to arrive at like, it's fine in moderation, but I don't think we quite get there.
We don't at all. What were you going to say, Emily?
This is like, you know, when you do like one, when they like deprogram you from a cult by just like, you know, like hitting you in the face a bunch, by giving you too much cult all the time, mm-hmm. like giving you a different cult to sort of glom yourself onto and then deprogramming you from that. This is kind of like that. John Ritter is just like full immersion therapy and realizes I don't actually need television that much. That said, like, I think that watching television together is often a way that couples bond. And like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So what is this? But just like John Ritter and Pam Dauber getting really into like, I don't know, Ted Lasso or something.
They would be into Ted Lasso. They,
feel
they like
would
Ted,
be into
they
Ted Lasso.
They feel like a Ted Lasso couple. I think that you're looking at it though, Phil, in terms of like, you know, as an adult thinking of this as like, it's about the couple coming together. I don't think I think this is a kid's movie and it's sort of secondary. I mean, all that really matters is that like, he's a bad
dad,
husband and father who is like way too into television. And that has to be fixed somehow. I think that there's actually not anything going on here beyond the desire to parody a bunch of stuff and have them travel through, you know, satanic parodies of our favorite shows and movies and stuff you've never heard of. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's, I think you're maybe asking too much of Stay Tuned.
I think, Phil, I think you're looking at this as an adult who expects stories to make sense and have thematic coherence.
That's my mistake.
And like,
all over my face. I feel terrible, but I guess you make a good point, Lewis, in terms of, as I was watching this film, I also was thinking of stuff like Airplane and Naked Gun and those kind of things, because those movies have also that kind of scattershot parody of things inside things that have subsequently turned into like your scary movies and your what have yous. And this feels like some sort of a kind of in between of those things. Cause I did find myself like some of the jokes, some of the like TV parodies, not so much the like the extended versions when they're actually inside them, but like some of those like one-off jokes were actually like I did sort of laugh. Three Men and Rosemary's Baby is kind of funny.
Great bit.
Would watch, right?
Like, maybe the best one, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Northern Overexposure, sure. A joke that, like, kind of works then, sort of. Yes, Emily?
I feel like part of the problem is they arrange the jokes all wrong. Like, their last big pun joke is driving over Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
And that
one
was
work.
A joke I could have made at like 7. I could have been like, oh, driving over Miss Daisy. And then like everyone would have been like, ha ha ha, and patted me on the head.
Yeah.
I do not pat Stay Tuned on the head. That joke, when we get to rating, I'm going to rate it. And I'm going to be like, I got to drop 2 points for that joke. Just remind me. I'm going to
I will remind you.
It's also so lazy because they're worried we won't get it. And they have a billboard that says driving over Miss Daisy, which why would there be a billboard for the movie?
I
think that that's what's so fascinating watching it now is that like the range of things they're parodying doesn't actually make any sense.
Yep.
And I do think that it does. It is an interesting time capsule. It definitely captures what it was like to watch TV in the early 90s when you were truly channel surfing, which is an experience that people don't have anymore. So we get like, you know, Doogie Howser and a Hair Club for Men commercial. And it's like in a, you know, an old movie. And that feels like something that you'd actually see on TV, but it doesn't. I feel like it's sort of a cheat that they parody movies also.
Yep.
I feel like they parody Wayne's World, which is a sketch from SNL that also was a movie that came out same year
year, but it came out later, if I'm not mistaken.
So they're really parodying.
They're shooting it as they're shooting this, if I remember correctly.
But... Right. So they're parodying the SNL sketch. It's also barely a parody, by the way.
You know what? I'm wrong. It's February of 92. I'm totally wrong. Wayne's World has come out in theaters. My apologies.
It's not really a parody. Yeah, is my point.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I just feel like they were prescient in terms of they saw Wayne's World coming. I want to ask a question about hell.
Sure. About hell?
Yeah.
Can I just before you dive into that, because I would love to. We will talk about hell very much so. I do want to unpack the Dwayne's Underworld thing for a quick second. First of all, it is Lewis's background right now, and it's great. He's flanked perfectly by two impersonators of Dwayne and So I don't think that bit worked at all. It was sort of weird because it's an extended bit. And by that, I mean, it gets an actual unpacking as opposed to these one-off jokes, right? So we have John Ritter inside the actual, you know, Dwayne's Underworld thing. And I guess my point more than anything is it didn't feel, it felt a little mean-spirited and a little kind of gross. And I don't know that that's like, that's not really Wayne's World. Not to defend Wayne's World, but do you know what I'm saying?
So you're upset Wayne's with the parody on the grounds that you feel like it was unfair to Wayne and Garth, the real Wayne and Garth.
I mean, I guess that's one way of putting it. I do feel a little bit like I understand satanic versions of things. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting too much thought into this. It's just the jokes just didn't play.
I can tell you, you're definitely putting too much thought into it. I agree that it doesn't work. I think it doesn't work because it's like barely a parody, and
that term.
The level of physical harm in these are so variable.
Yes.
And this one's like you're gonna get a red hot poker in the eye, which is obviously it's a little much for a kid's movie. He avoids that fate, but
it's true.
Yeah, it's weird. It's also very short and doesn't really change anything from the actual Wayne's World. They changed the way they swing because it's already too adult for a kid's movie. So they just kind of change the motion of their hips.
Sure. But there's also like a kind of a pedophilia joke kind of put in there where it's like he's talking about his daughter and like they have like a playboy of his wife. It's a weird thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I guess when I watched it as a kid, it seemed totally fine. So now I'm, you know, I do like the I worship Satan part.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, a good bit. One joke,
and a good segue into Emily's questions about hell.
Yes, please, hell. Yes, Emily.
Okay, so within the Stay Tuned universe, I'm going to get all of us in trouble with this. Within the Stay Tuned universe,
doubtful,
hell has like ramped up production seemingly supernaturally quickly on a whole bunch of shows in a whole bunch of different genres. They're trying to make a little bit of everything just so they can make sure they can catch somebody. They all seem kind of a little bit low rent, like they're a little bit worse than they should be. Mm-hmm. Is hell Netflix is what I'm asking.
I mean,
like back then it plays as like channel surfing, but now you're like, this is kind of like browsing Netflix a little bit.
It is a little bit like that. So I do feel like we need to give a little bit of context because it's possible that our listeners have not seen Stay Tuned.
I can't imagine, but go
so
ahead.
I do want to give just a little bit of context so people understand where we're coming from. And then I feel like we can get deeper into Emily's existential questions of hell versus Netflix. Salesman Rob Nabel, I believe it's Nabel, right? Played by John Ritter, spends all his free time watching television to the exasperation of his wife, Helen, played by Pam Dauber. One day, TV salesman Spike, played by Jeffrey Jones, convinces Roy to buy a satellite dish offering 666 channels. The new addition to Roy's home entertainment system sucks him and Helen into Hellvision, a realm run by Spike, who is an emissary of Satan. For 24 hours, the couple must survive devilish parodies of TV programs as they want to return to reality alive. Stay Tuned opened on August 14th, 1992, against Unforgiven, Single White Female, Death Becomes Her, Three Ninjas, A League of Their Own, and of course, The Mighty Ducks.
God, what a weekend.
It would go on to make $12 million on a $15 million budget. Yes, Emily?
No, I'm listening.
Stay Tuned has 47% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 55% from audiences. The New York Times called the film a clever plotted movie based on a nifty satiric concept, but that most of its takeoffs show no feel for genre and no genuine wit. The Washington Post called the film wonderfully silly and a zippy action spoof. And Variety said the film was not diabolical enough for true black comedy, too scary and violent for kids lured by his PG rating, and witless in its send-up to obsessive TV viewing, a picture with nothing for everybody. It noted that the six-minute cartoon interlude by the masterful Chuck Jones, with Ritter and Dauber portrayed as mice menaced by a robot cat, has a grace and depth sorely lacking in the rest of the movie.
Wow. That's that nothing for everybody is so good. I love that so much. Great line, Variety critic. I actually, I coincidentally have a Wikipedia page open to the Oscars from that year.
Oh,
and
yes,
Stay Tuned received no nominations.
Oh, no nominations. None.
Was this pre-visual effects?
No, there's a visual effects category. And,
okay, so that is
a true snub as far as I'm concerned.
It was won by Death Becomes Her.
Sure.
And then Death Becomes Her defeated Alien 3 and Batman Returns. And you know what?
Interesting.
Like this was before they had 5 in that category every year. So I bet fourth was Stay Tuned. I bet Stay Tuned
was. There were people picketing outside, I bet, being like, Justice for Stay Tuned.
But I do think, I agree that whatever. But I do think this movie is pretty, Peter Himes, who directed this film, who very much wanted to direct this film, like championed for this movie, was relentless in his desire to want to direct this film, which I think is fascinating. This movie has vision. This movie is well done in terms of from a production perspective. It's well shot. Some of the effects are pretty decent. I think that this is all just a long way of saying that I think that the excitement for a director to be able to jump into all these different sandboxes, right, and to be able to play in all these different genres must be really enticing, and for the most part are executed relatively well. I just think the script isn't as good as it could be, but I think that the execution of it is
but the execution is also kind of baffling, because as I was saying, they could just parody TV shows. It's very weird that it hinges so much on film noir and westerns and a fencing situation. I think it would feel less incoherent even if it were the same sort of energy and aggressiveness of the sheer number of parodies we get, if it were parodies of TV dramas and sitcoms and Charles Manson Leave It to Beaver we get a snippet of for the bike bit. As a TV fan would certainly be more appealing. Otherwise it's kind of just it's a lot of movie parodies. And I think if you look at the number of, I think the puns are almost all movies. there are obviously some exceptions. I don't know. I mean, I really, obviously they earned the Three's Company joke. So kudos to them for that.
Kudos to them.
They cast two TV stars.
Yeah. Why is there no Mork and Mindy parody?
Maybe she said no.
I don't think there were any Stan Daubers working on this film.
I do think, like, watching it, it made me a little sad because I was watching the Jeopardy High School Reunion Tournament, and there was like a softball question about I Love Lucy, and none of them got it because they're all like 19. And I was like, when I was 19, I knew a lot about I Love Lucy because I watched Nick at Night, and I watched, like, I grew up on like Three's Company and all sorts of sitcoms from the 70s and 80s and obviously earlier. And I was like, now I'm just going to be one of those people who's like, kids today don't understand.
No, but you're not wrong.
I made me a little nostalgic for that era of channel surfing and like seeing old shows. And I kind of wish the movie selfishly were more about that and less about like, how do we get a Salt-N-Pepa music video into this?
I mean, we're going to get
so good. It's great. It's great.
It's great.
You ever just think about how people who are 19 now and could credibly be guests on this podcast were born in 2004? You ever just
I don't
want to
talk about that.
That?
I don't
That's want to. Great. I do wonderful. Think about that. Yeah.
I want to kind of piggyback on what you were saying, Lewis, because I think there's something to the fact that what you're also speaking of are branded channels, right? That had like a lane that they stayed in. Right. And part of the problem now is these streamers are brandless, for lack of a better way of putting it. Right. Like it's you mentioned it earlier with Netflix or whatever the case might be. So I think what this all kind of comes to is I Love Lucy is readily available to any 19-year-old that wants to watch it on Hulu or Paramount Plus or wherever it is. They either A, don't know it's there, or B, don't care to watch it, or whatever the case might be.
They tried watching, realized the episodes were missing, and didn't realize that I had complained repeatedly on Twitter, and the episodes were reinstated, probably unrelated, but correct. I take credit for it.
I'm thinking about this in terms of what you're saying, Phil, and like this is already outdated as parody because the era of like every channel has a specific niche thing is just ramping up. And this just seems to be like the experience of between five or six channels where they're all showing something like Food Network, which from my memory was like the network where everybody was like, oh boy, they'll make a channel for everything now. It was like 1993. So we're like right on the cusp of all of that happening. Yes. And, you know, this movie is very much parodying a TV world that was already dying as it was being made, much less the one we live in now.
It's, you know, it does feel a little bit like, there's a good movie here, just to be clear. Like, I think that there is some interesting ideas and obviously some great jokes and what have you, but it does feel a little too scattershot. You know, Emily, you tweeted the other day that this movie exhausted you, which says something, obviously, because Emily is impossible to exhaust. So I do think that it's sort of... it really kind of only has one joke a little bit, right? Like it only has one thing that it's kind of hitting you over the head with. And it's interesting because, so I'm sure you guys maybe knew this. Maybe our listeners do too. Tim Burton almost made this film. So this was he got this script. He was going to make this script, make this film, and then ultimately decided to do Batman Returns, which I'm personally thankful he did.
I was going to say terrible choice, but sure.
I mean, he just, I only say he made the choice just because like after the first one, he was very kind of over it. And they basically just backed up a Brinks truck to his house and said, you can do whatever you want, which is how we got Batman Returns. A movie that clearly is completely unhinged and wonderful. But I understand why he would gravitate towards something like this, because you watch this film and you do see sort of shades of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, shades of Beetlejuice to a certain degree. Like there is this kind of manic kind of craziness. Like Beetlejuice as a script is basically makes no sense. I don't know why they go to Saturn, and there's all sorts of things that we don't really understand. But you're kind of along for the ride, right? And there's that intent and that filmmaker that you feel has their hands firmly planted on the wheel. That's not how you feel here, right? Like you don't feel necessarily like Peter Himes really controls the tone of this film particularly well.
You could see where I think the problem is. It's a great high concept,
yeah,
but like you have nowhere to go with it other than a long series of like parodies. And inherently, like, that's just, there's no story there. You know, you can't really progress through it. So you've either got to develop a much more sophisticated, like, lore, basically, or you need to, like, you know, narrow it into like one sort of parody of something, and it just, like, it can't,
because there's no mission. The mission is to survive, right? And when I say, like, there's no puzzle to solve, there's nothing that's actually, like, if there was some sort of a shitty MacGuffin or something that was inserted into this thing so that you're watching I can't remember their names, Pam and
The Nables.
If
Helen and Roy Nables.
Roy and Helen.
Classic film characters.
Yes, my apologies. If they had something that they needed to achieve or something that they needed to solve, I think it would have given you more to hold on to as opposed to just, I need to survive.
Or what if they made friends with a giant ant? Just spitball.
That'd be cool,
that
too.
That is what every movie needs. I mean, they kind of almost do. They have, like, they get the remote. Yes, suddenly, yes, yes. Very late in the movie. I mean, it's an 89-minute movie, but I just mean
feels
that,
longer.
Like, it does feel longer. They sort of eventually find something. I don't know. I mean, there's really no point beyond them surviving. The rules are also quite confusing, I must say, because because their neighbors end up in there for longer than 24 hours. Because there's already a news report about them missing. So it's...
Yeah, time is weird there.
It's very confusing. And yeah, that's a whole separate conversation. I don't think looking for plot holes in this movie is, like, really a good use of my time. But I do feel like, yeah, they're kind of... It's spinning its wheels. It also, like... The parodies, as we discussed, are sort of, like, all over the place and feel a little bit off base. They start with a game show, which feels... That makes sense to me. It's on the poster.
Yep.
And then they go into wrestling, which doesn't quite feel like what they're getting at. It's also not really a parody. It's just like they're wrestling. It's not really heightened. I mean, I've seen things like that in actual wrestling. I don't think it's anything that we, like, you know, is like so shocking or hellish. But it doesn't, it instantly kind of, like, loses me. I mean, as a kid, you did not, but watching it now, where I'm like, I don't really quite get what they're going for here, or why the next step from game show isn't like some other kind of classic TV.
Yeah, they're not connected to each other, which is maybe the most sort of discombobulating part of it. Like, as a viewer, you're sort of like, how are we getting from one thing to the next? And the short answer is, the writers want them to. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, wouldn't it be fun if we did this and this and this? But, like, there's also these moments where it feels like the movie is kind of treading water a little bit, like when they're stuck in that shack and the wolves are out. I sound like a crazy person saying they're stuck in a fishing shack and there's wolves outside.
That's
that want
northern to kill them. Northern overexposure. Yeah,
was that what that was?
That's northern overexposure. Yeah,
famous northern exposure plot right there.
Yeah, so northern overexposure.
I didn't put that together.
Well, then we learn from the voiceover that it's a show about basically the plot of northern exposure, but someone freezing to death instead of, like, anything else that happens. That's the
That went over. I missed that part. My apologies. But
it was really key to the plot, but it's fine.
But it's they kind of tread water there for a bit because they need to cut back to reality and have, like, the kid piecing together what's going on. So they need kind of these stop gaps where things, quote unquote, aren't happening on television so that we're not missing stuff, if that makes sense.
It also feels like they're in the French Revolution for a long time.
Ever.
A long time.
Like, that's the payoff. This movie pays off with a French Revolution TV movie. I don't know. There's choices that are made. We'll kind of jump through some of these because I do want to talk about them, obviously. But I do also want to give just a little bit of context for some of the production stuff. 1990, Jim Genewier and Thomas S. Parker wrote the entire story for the film under the working title Terror Vision. That was the original title. Inspired by the idea of Evil Dead meets Monty Python. I mean, okay. I don't know that I necessarily...
Well, I mean, do they write, like, a darker R-rated version of this? Because that also would...
I don't know.
That would work. I mean, that's a different movie.
And would maybe work better, quite honestly, if you were able to lean into the satanic horror components of it. But all that being said, script was purchased by Warner Brothers for $750,000, which in 1992 is, it's a lot of money now. The studio had cast Richard Dreyfuss and Tracy Ullman originally as Roy and Helen. But they dropped out because I guess additionally between the two of them, it would have made the budget go up by $500,000. And they were like, they're too expensive. I personally think the casting of two TV stars makes more sense, quite honestly. Like,
it's great.
Right?
Perfect. I do wonder if they didn't do a Mork and Mindy parody to return to an earlier point, because you just can't parody Robin Williams, you know, without him there. Like his, yeah. there were a bunch of guys around this time who were trying to be Robin Williams and they all failed miserably, except of course the guy that starred in the TV show Rhythm and Blues on NBC, which is a show that I inexplicably loved at this point in time that we should do an episode about if it aired in 1992. I'm not sure if it did.
What's it about?
It's about, okay, so here's the premise. this is you're gonna be like, what? That I love this show. It is about a white man,
yes,
who gets a job at a like soul station that's all run by black people. And like, it's a kind of a clash of cultures thing where like he comes in and like he has like they're all learning lessons from each other. But he's also a Robin Williams type. So he can do a voice on the radio that makes him sound as though he belongs working at this station. And this is an aspect of the show I did not totally understand what was going on, because I lived in a town that was all white people. And I just like was like, I thought it was a funny radio station comedy and the guy did voices, because he did a lot of voices. He did the Robin Williams thing. Sure. But yes, the premise is very racist, so we won't be doing that.
Super racist.
And I was thinking that sounds less racist than I expected as you were describing it. And the star of that show is obviously still famous to this day.
Yeah, no, yeah, obviously it's Rob Williams, right?
Oh God, this did air in 1992. We could no, it's Roger Kabler. He plays Bobby Soul. Here's how the premise is explained on Wikipedia. Rhythm and Blues stars Kabler as Bobby Soul, a white man who gets hired on a black radio station after being initially mistaken as a black man. The cast also includes Ron Glass. It was a great cast. It was like there was a show in there about like that flips the usual like racial dynamic of the American sitcom. Uh-huh. I don't believe that Rhythm and Blues found that show.
Listen, I'm open to talking about the pilot of Rhythm and Blues whenever you're ready. Emily.
Let's remake Rhythm and Blues, Phil. Let's
not
pitch it.
Do
let's
that.
Take it out
let's
around
not
town.
Do that.
Let's make it. Let's make it sensitive for this time.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
The other person that was apparently considered for the role of Ron was Dan Aykroyd, which makes sense-ish, I guess. But again, like I stand by the fact that casting two TV stars is the way to go.
Well, it absolutely makes sense. The casting feels really clever to me.
Yeah.
But then it's the whole thing of like, if this felt like a parody of TV shows, that would be great. But it's not really.
I agree. It doesn't commit fully to the TV thing, which is weird, considering obviously its premise. It seems to me a little bit of like, the studio probably just got scared, right? And they were just like, people are going to the movies. They're going to pay money to see this at the movies. Do they want to be seeing TV shows? Like, it's this whole like disconnect of like, that there was some sort of church and state going on between TV and film. You know, for the longest time, obviously. And I just wonder whether or not they're like, we need more movies in this, or people are going to forget they're seeing a movie or something.
It's just, yeah, I get that. I think it's interesting because like, if the thing that we're supposed to be afraid of and at this time that it's the movie sort of exploiting is like, we're watching too much TV. It's like, were people watching too many Westerns? Were they watching too many like old Hollywood movies? I think it's more like they're watching junk. And I think the movie doesn't commit to that idea that like the you know of this excess of you know TV we don't care about. I mean, I think we barely get a glimpse of a Home Shopping Network, which I'd love to see more of. I think the commercials, like some of them kind of work, but it doesn't really it doesn't feel like it's at all that era.
It's not committed to the bit, weird.
Right.
I feel like if there was a Home Shopping Network bit, it would be like M. Night Shyamalan's cameo in Knock at the Cabin. Like that would be that would be I do want to push back against this a little bit, because I feel like the things that we spend extended amounts of time in are TV parodies, where we spend quite a bit of time in the game show. We spend quite a bit of time in the wrestling match, and like the wrestling match is not a TV show per se.
Yeah.
We spend quite a bit of time in Northern Overexposure. We spend quite a bit of time in the Chuck Jones cartoon, which granted that would have originated as a movie short, but like by then was so heavily associated with TV. and we spend like a lot of time. I do feel like the French Revolution thing kind of straddles the line, but it does have sort of a PBS masterpiece.
Yeah, that I'm fine with. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
So like the one-off jokes are almost all movie parodies, and they really feel like there was a script. And then the studio was like, hey, we got to get some movie jokes in there. So just, you know, just toss something.
It's, I guess also there's a part of me too that's like, I'm trying to kind of articulate this idea that like not understanding what people get from television, if that makes sense. There's like just a big misunderstanding of like that we just want to be like lemmings or drones or something like that. And we just want to kind of sit there in front of this boob tube, which I think is very much kind of a 90s mentality. You know what I mean? Late 80s, early 90s.
Well, it's almost, I mean, but it's almost getting at something different because it's like he has a terrible job. Well, he hates his life. He watches these movies and acts like he's a character in the movie and tries to kind of reclaim his former glory. It's not explored at all.
Too, by his wife.
Right. And then they call her in the wrestling match Helen the Harridan. But he like, it seems like he's getting something out of TV that is not actually explored.
Right.
And that sort of comes into play with the, like the, you know, the film noir where he's like, you know, a sexy, suave, private eye. What is it? Private dick. There's a dick joke in there. That's not PG. I mean, it is PG. It's not a PG joke.
You're making a really interesting point because the movie does feel like it starts from this place with Roy's character of he's emasculated. He's obviously disconnected from his family, his wife, his kids, his only quote unquote friends, or he only feels empowered when he's watching television. And then there's this notion within the movie within the TV shows, within the movie, that he desperately wants to be a hero, of which he never really becomes until, like, I guess the very end when the kids throw him the sword kind of through the satellite dish so he can fight. Like,
you know,
you seem frustrated by this natural plot development.
You know, I read that AMC tried to develop this as a series. I'm and sure. I was like, does anyone remember this? But when you describe it that way, it sounds a lot like the pilot for Breaking Bad. So,
but it is, I mean, it really is this sort of, this guy that's lost his joie de vivre, he's lost his spine, he's lost his whatever, and the only thing he cares about is watching television. And then in theory, throughout this journey, I guess we're supposed to believe that this guy finds the life he wants, reconnects with his family and wife, but it's sweaty.
I mean, I think that you're getting at what they're what they maybe were implying, but it's not really about that. I do kind of want to know how they would do it as like an AMC series. I think that, like, because lots of TV shows will do episodes that are, you know, I'm just thinking like Supernatural did one that was like, I'm trying to think of shows that aren't Supernatural right now, but obviously none come to mind. Obviously, like Kevin Can Wait or Kevin Can't Wait or Kevin Goes. What was the Kevin? What's the Kevin show?
Kevin Can Go Fuck Himself.
Kevin can go fuck himself. Thank you. Was basically this our version of this, and it's an interesting concept that I think if you know, I think this movie is much more heavily on the side of like the developed part of it is like Hellvision and the people who work there, which is not interesting, but I don't think that the non Hell side has too much on its mind.
Go ahead, Emily.
I'm thinking about. This is just a question I have. Mm-hmm. Do you think TV is better at making fun of TV and movies are better at making fun of movies? Because I think that's true.
Yes.
But I haven't like done a lot of great. Because like this around this time, The Simpsons is at its creative peak and is so good at mocking television in like ways that are incisive and funny. And like The Simpsons is pretty good at making fun of movies. They have some good movie parodies, but I would argue they're not as good at that as they are at making fun of television. So like,
there are some movies that I think do a good job of like really digging deep into the kind of psychosis of television, if you will, or like I'm thinking of movies like Network, even kind of like the TV set, that Jake Kasdan movie. Like, I think there are movies that can make fun of the business of television, but when it comes to like actually being like doing parodies of television, I don't think they're particularly good at it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Like network is totally different. Yeah, you know, it's like a satirical take on the medium.
Yes.
That's a thing that I think movies are good at, but like a parody of television programming. Yes. No. Yeah.
I agree 100%. I want to take a quick second just to talk about Peter Himes as a filmmaker, because
I looked legend. Up at Wikipedia. I had no idea.
This is
legend.
An outlier in a quite interesting filmography. I'm not gonna go through all of them, but like, you know, the big ones, Capricorn One was probably his first big film. Then he's got The Star Chamber in 83, does the 2010 remake, the sequel to 2001, which is interesting. The Monster Squad, he was an executive on, he didn't direct that, but The Presidio, Narrow Margin. What you're noticing here is that he does thrillers, that he does sort of action movies. He's not a comedy director. So this movie is a real outlier, because like this happens, he does Time Cop 2 years later, which is a big success, the Jean-Claude Van Damme film. He does another Jean-Claude Van Damme film, Sudden Death. He does The Relic, that weird Penelope Ann Miller. Oh my God, who's the other guy in it? I'm trying. Sizemore, that's who it is. In 99, he's got a legit great action supernatural. End of Days is a good movie. The Arnold Schwarzenegger fights the devil movie, actually a pretty good
movie. All I remember about that movie is the trailer. I think I probably mentioned this in the Stigmata episode.
Yep, we did.
Was in the trailer when it said 1999, and it flipped upside down and said 666, and I was like, oh my God, the signs have been there all along. We were warned.
Yep.
I'll mention that every time you have me on, I will mention that from the trailer of End of Days.
Here's what's interesting. There's a thread, it seems, with your appearances, and the thread is Satan.
I honestly had not considered that until this moment, but I do think this is a better developed sense of hell and
I agree.
What people might do there, sure. Which apparently is work for, you know, I don't know what Hellvision is exactly. It's like it's Netflix. Yeah, why lie? They work
but
for Netflix.
I do think that it is interesting, because, and not to make this about Stigmata versus Stay Tuned, because these are two very different films, but
no, let's fucking do this. It's happening.
But Stigmata is also kind of nonsensical in a different way, right? Like it's going this. Stay Tuned is not supernatural particularly. Like it's certainly heightened. It's I don't know that supernatural is the right word.
Do you think it's grounded in reality?
No, I don't think it's grounded in reality, but I don't know that I would like it does. When I think supernatural, I think like magic, monsters. You know what I mean? Like that's not really
you don't think kitchen sink drama. Like Stay Tuned.
Well, this is
exactly.
Well, this is
see,
more,
you understand
this is,
me, Emily.
This is like bureaucratic, because you're getting like contracts and like they're looking for a loophole and No, I get it.
This is a fucked up weird game, right? Like this is like a weird puzzle game type thing. I don't know.
I feel like extended Christian mythology, which I would place this under, I guess, counts as fantasy. I feel like some of the earliest fantasy texts would like have the devil as a character. So yeah, I think that when the after the apocalypse, when someone rediscovers the Bible, I'm gonna do my best to get Stay Tuned inserted as Apocrypha. Like it'll be great.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
This movie also presents the idea that God or some sort of force in heaven knows this is all happening and is fine with it because they have rules, which is interesting. I think this movie is critical of God in a fascinating way.
I love how often there's this plot of like hell isn't getting enough souls.
Yep.
And we got to step it up.
Yep.
We got to invent this way to get more souls. And it's just like, how? Like it feels like everything else about this movie should be about how television is dragging people to hell. Like that is the implicit thing of the subtext, but it just is like, oh, we, you know what, we got to kill people inside a television so they can go to hell and we can claim their souls. I'm getting hung up on the eschatology of it, so let's
well
move
no
on.
I do think it's, I mean that is interesting that there's like a trope of like hell needs souls. It's like Mars needs moms, you know. It's just a thing that we accept as reality.
It's what it is. So Emily, I want to pivot this to something else that this film reminded me of, and it's something close to your heart, which is Christmas. This movie reminds me a little bit of Scrooged. You know, I'm thinking of some of their TV shows that that movie had a similar kind of vibe to them, and also sort of that him being thrown into all these different things. Like, it does kind of have a little bit of that vibe to it as well.
I did a quick search on some academic sites. It does not appear that any theology students have ever written a paper about Stay Tuned, which is too bad. This film does kind of feel like Scrooge. Scrooge is not my favorite movie, but I will say this. It's a lot better than Stay Tuned. So it's got that going for it. But yeah, this thing of when a movie tries to capture the feeling of watching TV, which some of these do. Scrooge, not as much, but definitely like... there is just like just your brain like rejects it in some weird way. Although we saw a lot of people on Twitter saying this played all the time on cable, and I can imagine it working perfectly in that scenario.
Did you watch a lot on HBO, Lewis, when you were?
I think it was a rental slash. It was not a rental. It was on a VHS tape that had been taped for me. There's no way that. This was something that I watched constantly. I think that. You're right about TV parodies. I'm thinking about in the movie Bros, which I enjoyed, there's that Queer Eye parody and it feels so fake. It feels such like an SNL joke. Yeah. And it's like, I just think it's really hard to do TV parody in a movie and have it feel real and have it not feel like kind of cheap and like a little bit of a throwaway gag. And so, you know, I think that while I want this to be more about TV, I don't know if that would be helpful if the whole thing were just like, you know, TV shows and jokes about TV shows. I think it would maybe play fine on cable, but less so in a movie theater.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's weird because like there does seem to be a little bit of so I was thinking about the John Ritter and Pam Dauber of it all as I was watching
Stan Dauber. I'm a Stan Dauber.
Stan Dauber, my apologies. I was thinking about, I mean, it's people have talked about this all the time about how hard it is for TV actors to transition to features and how rare that is. And part of that has to do with the fact that I think even Clooney said it, that like, you know, when you're on their TV in their house every week, you're their friend. But when you're on a giant screen that they have to go to the movies to see, you seem larger than life and you don't seem as approachable. You don't seem as sort of, you know, living in their house, for lack of a better way of putting it. And I do think that there is something about this kind of jarring that this film is kind of got trying to have his cake and eat it too, where it's got these two TV stars trying to be movie stars in a movie about TV that also has movie parodies. Like it's just not fully in a baked into one camp that makes it also feel a little bit kind of just kind of neither fish nor fowl.
Listen, I know that we run like the careers of most of the actors that we talk about.
Sure.
And like we should do John Ritter because he's actually kind of like the height of his movie stardom at this point because he's coming off the Problem Childs. But I want to run through Pam Dauber from Mork and Mindy on.
Well, Stan Dauber should obviously run through.
Stan, yeah, okay. So yeah, she does Mork and Mindy, that's big hit, you know.
Yeah.
She does the TV movie Remembrance of Love, which of course we all remember. She's a voice on the Mork and Mindy Laverne and Shirley Fonz Hour. She does Through Naked Eyes, Last of the Great Survivors, This Wife for Hire. Of course, we know all those movies. Wild Horse is the TV movie. She's in an episode of The Twilight Zone. Then she does, of course, the classic American Geisha, not insensitive at all. Quiet Victory, there's this show she was on for two seasons that was like kind of a hit that nobody remembers called My Sister Sam. That's like impossible to see. but like she was on that for a couple seasons. And then she's in a TV movie called Do You Know the Muffin Man in 1989, The Face of Fear in 1990. Yes, yes.
Did she know the Muffin Man?
She does. Okay. She does. That's the plot, is that she finds the Muffin Man and comes to know him. And then Rewrite for Murder. So like my point is, I believe this is her movie debut. I believe this is her feature film. No, wait. She's in Robert Altman's A Wedding in a small part. So okay. She goes from okay. A Wedding to Stay Tuned.
This is her first like, starring role in a movie.
Yeah, exactly. And then I don't believe she's been in a movie since.
Once you've peaked, you don't really need to, you know, let it go.
She's in the movie. She's in the 1999 movie, I'll Remember April, which maybe you covered on the old show, Phil, but it's a Haley Joel Osment vehicle.
That's not
vehicle.
A movie that exists. It is interesting because, like, I don't know. I do think that on some level, you do get kind of, as a viewer, you get programmed that this person can only be this thing, right? Mm-hmm. It is tough when you play Fox Mulder for 150 episodes or however many episodes, like how do you see David Duchovny as anything other than Fox Mulder? How do you break out of that stuff? And I mean, Pam Dawber's performance on Mork and Mindy is great. She is great mm-hmm. on that show. So the like, problem, I get it to some degree.
The problem with her is that her star persona is reacting and right. That's great on television. Yeah. It's hard to make play in a movie unless like she wanted to jump in and do a bunch of roles where she plays a supportive wife. But she had the misfortune of being alive in the 80s and 90s when those roles were going to like fucking Meryl Streep because they were like that was like all the female parts that were being written. Like you look at Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, again, a movie I keep invoking.
Yes.
The wife character there is played by Marcia Strassman of I'll Welcome Back Kotter fame. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this was the kind of thing if you were in that zone where like your job was reacting to a guy who was much bigger and doing more traditionally funny things, you kind of got stuck with stuff like this. And you know, that was what really I Pam, you deserve better. Come on the show. We'll talk about Beethoven.
I'd love to talk with Beethoven.
You know what her best, I think her best performance within this movie, her best scene in this movie is the scene on Emily's background. When she plays a cartoon mouse.
She's great. She does
so
a lot
good.
Of voiceover.
She's good.
Yeah.
She's, and I do think it is interesting because this is going to be a bizarre tangent, but bear with me. A couple weeks ago, I did Kramer versus Kramer and Marriage Story on the Patreon for double features. And the opening of Kramer versus Kramer and Stay Tuned are not all that dissimilar in the sense that Pam Dawber, similar to Meryl Streep, is like
go ahead, great,
is like I'm done, right? Like she's just like I can't deal with this marriage anymore, I'm walking away from this marriage. And she's good in that scene in terms of juggling the drama and the comedy of what she's trying to sort of navigate. And I do think that right into the game show and that scene that they have together where they're quizzed about their fidelity and their relationship and is interesting. And her, like, I don't want to be too heady about this, but I'm just going to say that I do think she's great in that scene. They're both good in that scene because it's the most raw and exposed of their marriage kind of for the rest of the movie, quite honestly. It's like they're really put into the sort of the lion's den in the beginning of like, are you cheating? Why are you guys so apart from each other? Her being the one that figures out a lot of this shit, quite honestly, in terms of how to get out of most of these
things.
She
figures that out way, way too quickly, in my opinion.
Sure.
There's actually, I believe there are only two questions in the game show.
Correct.
And she immediately understands that the second one is a trick question. I feel like they maybe cut something from that because that sequence is weirdly brief. And also, they don't react much to being on a game
dangled
show.
Over, yeah. Well, yes, that too.
They
yes.
seem like they instantly kind of adapt to that. I'm just stuck thinking about what a fun episode it must be talking about Kramer versus Kramer and Marriage Story back to
back. It was
a great
episode.
I'm sure it was great. I'm sure it was a barrel of laughs. But I think that she's not given much to do here with that. I mean, it doesn't really seem like we don't really know why their marriage is so bad other than that he watches TV a lot. She says he's jealous of her success, which like he probably yes. is, but we yes. don't get very much of that aside from her saying it.
And then unfortunately the climax of this movie is him saving her and her literally being a damsel in distress, which isn't great. Especially considering how obviously smart and effective she is in the first two thirds of the movie. You're sort of like, why does she have to be relegated to this kind of damsel in distress?
Because the movie is about returning them to traditional gender roles, and clearly he's not emasculated anymore. Now he's a Clint Eastwood, and he fences. So
yeah, he's sort of a what's the famous swashbuckler, Emily?
Errol Flynn.
That's it. So John Ritter, you mentioned earlier, Emily, was sort of at the if he was going to fully break out as a movie star or a movie actor, this is kind of in this radius. He's got this movie that I forgot even existed, which I've never seen, but weirdly have the poster burned in my brain. It's a movie called Skin Deep, this Blake Edwards movie that he was in. Do you know this movie? I've never seen it. It's an 89 movie about this author who has a weakness for alcohol and beautiful women. Jesus Christ.
Sounds amazing.
Sounds great. And yeah, the poster is to describe as sort of John Ritter in an all white suit in the arms of a bunch of supermodels. And the tagline is the comedy that glows in the dark. Anyway, that movie existed. It had a budget of $8 million and it made $45 million. That movie was a hit. Then he does Problem Child and Problem Child 2 back to back. And then we'll also be talking about him in Noises Off at some point, Emily, which was in 92 as well. But that's a big ensemble, so it's not really a John Ritter vehicle per se. And then he's in everyone's favorite film, North, in 94, a movie that only did wonders for everyone's career. So
I don't even heard. Sorry, go ahead, Emily.
I'm sorry. I'm furious that the Blake Edwards final film, Switch, is 91, because I feel like that was the advertisements for that were a seminal moment in my coming of age.
Switch is a good movie, though.
It is.
I kind of remember Switch being a good movie. I remember Alan Barkin being good in that movie, but I could be wrong.
Is it Switch? Is it a BDSM thing or is it
no?
It's a
body swap movie.
Jimmy Smits dies and is reincarnated as Alan Barkin to like solve a murder.
I don't think it's
something.
Jimmy Smits who dies.
Somebody dies. I've never seen it. I was not allowed to see it for some.
I'm not trying to be like
you've mentioned movies you weren't allowed to see, and I have to say that the movie that I was not allowed to see when I was a kid was Problem Child. Because that kid was just too problematic.
So that's how my parents felt about The Simpsons. Yeah.
So the person that she swaps is someone that I've never heard of. His name's Perry King. He's only in one scene, and he's this like promiscuous misogynist who's murdered at the beginning of the movie and essentially body swaps with one of his former lovers because he drowns in a hot tub. And it's a whole thing. But in Purgatory, God, communicating through male and female voices, gives Steve one chance at redemption, and he's returned to Earth alive and told that he must find a soulmate who truly loves him, but he has to do it in the body of Alan Barkin.
Let's take this out and pitch it around town. We'll have to do the modern update of Switch. It'll be great.
A lot of body swap comedies of that era, and a lot of like person goes to heaven and gets sent back.
Oh yeah,
movies like a lot
of them.
What was the one where is it Robert Downey Jr.?
Yes,
Heart and Souls.
Hearts and Souls.
Yes, there's that.
Love
and
that.
There's the other one.
Chances Are.
Yeah, that.
Yes.
These are all movies that I watched as a kid.
Chances Are was what's her name from Moonlighting?
Sybil Shepherd. Someone's getting reincarnated. Her dead yes. husband.
Her dead husband's reincarnated.
But it doesn't get the like whatever makes you forget your past life. Yeah, no, I and these are all so burned my memory.
It's a whole thing where Robert Downey Jr. has her dead lover's soul in him, so she falls in love with him, and it's a whole thing.
These were both those Robert Downey Jr. movies were big for me.
Jonathan Glazer remade it as Birth, and it was much creepier.
But this is all just to say, John Ritter, to your point, Emily, sort of had a moment, and then ultimately comes back to TV and does what's the show that he does for a few years?
Eight Simple Rules, the one that he made upon his death. Yeah,
yes. Mm-hmm. So he did that for 31 episodes. He did a ton of TV, obviously. He was, you know, he notoriously was very creepy on Felicity at one point, played
and
Ben's
Buffy.
Dad. And Buffy. He was great. I mean, this kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier, but sort of that state and church and state of like TV and movies being very separate. But like, there's nothing wrong with being a great TV actor that people love. Like, we have to stop that whole nonsense.
But I think that also has changed a lot because TV and movies are far less, you know, there's a lot more overlap now. And certainly, I mean, it used to be a big deal, obviously, for movie actors to do TV, sure, which is now the norm. Yes. And then you have Paul Mescal going from a Hulu series to like, yeah, movie superstardom, but it's a Hulu series, so it's like doesn't kind of feel the same as like a sitcom. I do think there is something about obviously being a TV star, a sitcom TV star, that is unique. I also think, I don't know that John Ritter ever had like a chance to really go beyond that, because even Problem Child, which I haven't seen again because I was banned, feels kind of like a sitcom-y type thing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Problem Child, other than obviously this kid was a real problem, was that it was a big hit, and it really kind of put him... did you know who wrote Problem Child? Scott Alexander and Larry Krasuski, which is incredible.
Isn't that like their first credit?
I believe it is. And Dennis Dugan directed it. Problem Child was put him squarely in like dad territory, right? And I think that, you know, hindsight being what it is, my guess is that after the success of Skin Deep, where he could play this kind of like suave, whatever, Blake Edwards type role, why would you slot him into like the dad role? Because then he just never gets out of it. He's dad forever. Like, there's just nothing that can be done about it. Problem Child is 81 minutes, by the way, with credits.
Guys. I think my parents wouldn't let me see that because, as an adoptee, movies about adopted kids being terrors was a real point of contention.
Sure.
They thought it would be traumatic. Maybe it would have been. I probably would have been.
It's amazing how quickly they turn around the sequel to Problem Child. Just for what it's worth, Problem Child 1 comes out July of 90. Problem Child 2 comes out literally in, I believe, June of 92. Like, they're just like, how quickly can we get a second Problem Child? Because it's about them getting another kid, obviously.
I can't believe that Problem Child 3 took so long to come out. And like the premise there was, we're going to add a problem child who's a girl. And like, of course,
no, that's Problem Child 2.
Problem Child 3. Oh, Problem Child 3 is called Junior in Love. Okay, I get it.
I
all right. So he's met a girl and he's in love. John Ritter didn't come back for some
Yeah, that's
reason.
Why I'm like, that's not on this filmography. I also forgot that John Ritter was in Sling Blade.
Anyway. Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. I do think, though, that it is kind of, once you've decided to cast these two TV stars, you know, you've locked yourself into something that I'm not sure the movie fully commits to. I want to talk about, I don't want to get into the logic of this movie, but I do just want to say this dish activations are arbitrary. I don't know why this dish all of a sudden wakes up. I don't know why all of a sudden it decides to like try to suck things into it, because there's like three other times when it happens. I'm just like, why is this happening? But anyway,
it seems like bad technology, because why would you want random people and things getting sucked in? You have to then account for them also.
Correct. Don't know.
Very confusing.
Very confusing. The Star Trek Next Generation thing was well done. Like, again, the execution of these different genre things is fun. I'm glad they didn't stay there too long, but like the makeup and the costumes and the set, like all that stuff.
Well, it's also well done because this movie, Geoffrey Jones is so scary. And I say that, you know, taking aside the allegations against him, he's so scary. And it's weird because this was like a movie that I watched a lot as a kid. I think of my, you know, I think I was like pretty skittish as a kid, but I also grew up in the 90s when like there was a lot of entertainment that the movies that I liked were pretty scary and felt like they were still kid appropriate. Mm-hmm. Like it was Gremlins 2, I watched Temple of Doom a lot. Like, these are things that are obviously scary and traumatizing, but you know, I was really into, but like watching it, I remember thinking Geoffrey Jones was scary. the scene where they're going through into hell and his giant face pops up.
Yep.
Very frightening. Very frightening. And I feel like part of why that Star Trek parody is so scary is because they all have his face. And it's very alarming. He's a scary guy.
Yeah. It's really unsettling. It's one of those things where it's tough to look at Geoffrey Jones now, obviously post very upsetting allegations. But also, like, he always
also. Okay, I mean, I believe he was convicted. In the
yeah, they're not allegations offender. Anymore. They're
but crimes, but I was trying to not get sued. But yeah, I mean,
it is interesting. He always kind of played a creep. Like the roles he played were never particularly, you know, warm and cuddly by any means. The ones that I think of that immediately come to mind are your Beetlejuices, your Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I guess on Deadwood he was fine. I don't know. Anyway,
that was post allegations.
Yeah, he's quite good on Deadwood, and he's also like. Yeah, that was after he'd been.
Well, the movie was after, right? When he
no,
he
no, no, no
the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. He was arrested in 2002.
I was shocked to learn this. I had no idea that was post arrest.
Neither.
You know what movie he's like a lovable dad in is Mom and Dad Save the World.
Is he in that?
He's the star. He's dad.
Well, I can't wait for us to talk about that one.
John Lovitz is the villain in that.
That sounds so good.
But Geoffrey Jones and Terry Garr are the parents. Great movie. But yeah, I mean, I think he is really creepy. And I think he just kind of adds this, I don't know, this level of unease to everything. Yep. Where when he shows up in those parodies, it's always, you know, a little bit creepier.
Yeah, it is definitely unsettling when it was certain. I mean, when he's got the data makeup from Star Trek: The Next Generation with the eye, like there was just stuff where you're just like, and when he's Worf, it's just like I don't like this. No part of this do I like. So I feel like now there's two things. Well, there's a couple things, but the Salt and Pepper music video, aka the climax of this movie. This movie chose to basically because like it's Salt and Pepper back into French Revolution. So it's kind of like it ping pongs between those two things.
I think it's Salt and Pepper into the Western.
And then there's also the swashbuckling.
There's
thing.
A swashbuckling.
Yeah, but this is when Pam Dauber is tied to the tracks.
Yes, and but he goes
John
into
Ritter
the,
is yes. Yeah, he goes back in. Salt and Pepper yes. is post French Revolution. He's already Correct. Been saved by the Deus Ex Machina.
Correct.
I didn't realize that this song was for the movie. I thought it was like a song that like had come out that they used, but it was a song for the movie that was later released on their greatest hits.
They were hoping to get an Oscar.
This movie has a banger soundtrack.
It really does.
I like looked up the soundtrack. It's on Spotify. Yeah.
I think that I will say, first of all, I noticed the soundtrack was released oddly recently. The soundtrack was released. It said like on Wikipedia, like 2011. Maybe misremembering. There's something where I was like, this came out much after the movie came out. I guess people were clamoring for the Stay Tuned soundtrack.
Spotify claims it's a 1992 release.
Okay, but, that's also possible. Wikipedia has failed me before. The music video part, I think, is interesting because, first of all, it's very much of the time. It made me think of the Vanilla Ice moment from Secret of the Ooze. Sure.
Yes.
But also, like, every movie needed a rap break. But also, it feels much more like a TV thing because it's like the era of music videos on MTV. And so that kind of felt more organic than a lot of the other stuff they did.
Yeah. I mean, it does. They cut out to like a big wide shot where they do kind of the MTV logo. So like it feels as though they kind of needed to kind of be like, it's TV. Don't worry. it's the song's great. You know, Emily sent us the music video, which we watched. And the music video feels like they literally just like lifted this sequence out of the movie. Like it's almost like it's kind of bizarre, but it's a great song. It's a real banger.
We talked about the classic television show Rhythm and Blues. I gotta say, whatever costume John Ritter's wearing in the music video sequence, I'm like, you know, I think it's questionable. Let's just put it that way.
When he showed up, I was like, no.
I really had a moment when I was like, is he in blackface? Because you really like there's a, you really can't tell at the start. I don't think he is, but like it looks like he is, at least momentarily.
I think it's the lighting.
It's the lighting. But it's intentional, and I don't like that.
Well, the hair is.
Well, yeah, no, that's right. At the very least, it's insensitive. It hasn't aged well. You know what else hasn't aged well about this movie? The parodies at the end, I was like writing them down, are the ones that I thought aged well. Murder, She Likes and Golden Ghouls are great. Those are perfect. I would argue that Unmarried with Children has not aged well. Why is that a satanic idea? However, David Dukes of Hazzard has aged very well.
Very well.
And is, in fact, almost prescient in terms of how we now view maybe Dukes of Hazzard and the iconography of that show. Yeah. So, you know, well done all around, except for the part that I just criticized as being a little weird.
It's a weird... I really wish that I... The movie opens with credits that I could only sort of describe as like Superman-esque. Of just sort of these big kind of colorful 3D things coming at you in this joyous score. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah, this movie's going to be just a ride. And then it's just not. It is kind of pummeling by the end. I kind of agree with Emily that like once we get through, it's like you've got the Star Trek Next Generation, Driving Miss Daisy, Three's Company, all kind of in quick succession as you're kind of bouncing through. It gets pretty exhausting. Like you do find yourself just being like, You're kind of kicking the shit out of me at a certain point.
They're also not like, I think you're talking about like, you know, I think of sitcoms and TV in general, I guess, especially, you know, of that time before as being more colorful than anything we get here. Yeah. It's very drab. Yeah. The Different Strokes joke, which is like obviously tasteless and bad, but like, it's also just like, I think that joke should look like Different Strokes looks. It's just like two old guys sitting on the couch. The 30 something to life joke, where they're in prison, is kind of fun, but none of it looks like a TV show. They didn't really try to kind of ape the visuals or the style of shows. So when they do the Three's Company parody, it's like almost shocking because it's just Three's Company and that's a very colorful show. And that feels more of the kind of tone that I want from this sort of thing.
No, I fully agree with you. I as soon as I found out that Tim Burton wanted to direct this, it really kind of changed my whole perspective on it a little bit. Cause I did sort of, that was kind of like an aha moment a little bit for me where I was like, yeah, I can see someone who would Tim Burton would wrap his arms around all of this like odd, dark humor in a way that would make it feel just slightly more palatable. And also just a little bit like, I don't know. I was thinking about like even Mars Attacks to a certain degree where you're just sort of like, he's willing to go there and go kind of full tilt in a way that just feels so much more pleasant, which makes me think of the other thing that I want to bring up, which is Pleasantville, which is sort of obviously the opposite of this movie in a lot of ways. It's one show instead of a bunch of shows, and it's the kids getting sucked into it and all of that,
and it's very good
and it's good.
Yeah.
and it's good. I would argue that Gary Ross gets a little over his skis at the end with the whole coloreds and the what have yous. Like it certainly starts to get a little bit
You don't think that's a sensitive metaphor? I think that's
I do not. but up until that point, that movie is great. And that is sort of it's a real love letter to television. Whereas this feels like it wants to kind of say like, no, and yes, it wants both. It's kind of, so the other thing that I wanted to ask you guys about, is this Rottweiler. There's a Rottweiler in this film that I think is supposed to be like a villain or something, but like, most of the shots that they cut to it, the dog doesn't look menacing at all. It just kind of looks like it's just like panting and it's just kind of there. And I just feel yes, Emily, it looks like you.
It feels like the Rottweiler is a thing that was in like the second draft. And we're on like draft 16. And there's been so many changes made that people forgot to take like just mentions of the Rottweiler out. So then like the director, like Peter Hyams, was like, there's a Rottweiler in this scene. They're like, well, it's in the script. And he's like, I guess we got to do that. So it really does feel like a random script artifact, or they digitally replaced the golden retriever with the Rottweiler.
I was going to say they probably cut the scene where the Rottweiler mauls the golden retriever. And that's why there's this continuity error on the poster.
Yeah.
It is really weird. I mean, I think that it's like, it's a little confusing. It sort of matters at the end in the sense that like the Rottweiler is the one who gets Spike. Like when there isn't the Rottweiler in the fence. Well, I mean, we can assume that he was torn to bits. I don't know. the movie's relationship to violence is very strange because it's mostly really cartoonish.
Yeah, like Eugene Levy's whole thing is he's torn apart by wolves, but.
Well, he's like frozen and dead, but it's a little bit it's like bloodless in a very weird way. Where I think to your earlier point about Tim Burton, he could have done more with this, where it could have seemed like there were high stakes and that it was like without being like brutally violent, could have had more like fear and you know something going on there.
Well, and also genuine whimsy. Right, like genuine kind of fantasy. The issue with this, there's many, but like one of the big issues I think ultimately is it's kind of joyless in a weird way. Whereas like Tim Burton's thing would have dialed everything; it all would have felt heightened, and it wouldn't have felt real, and it would have felt much more sort of fantasy oriented. And this movie has a weird reality fantasy issue that it's not really dealing with particularly well.
Is Eugene Levy this movie's auntie? From Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yes. And listen, Eugene Levy, every time I see him, I'm just happy to see Eugene Levy. Like, he's always funny. He's always great. Like, I don't know that he's given a ton to do here, but like...
I love that the like arts critic guy who works for Hellvision is from the guy from Dexter. Like, that is fantastic. God,
I did not ever make that connection until this time watching it, that it's Dokes, right? It's like the
Dokes. Yeah.
I mean, he's a USC film grad, which is very funny. I like Eugene Levy in this, obviously, because he's Eugene Levy. I do feel like we get kind of hints of there's a lot of exposition from him. Mm-hmm. And also kind of like hints at this larger hell world. I do have to say that the part where he's counting and his finger comes off made me believe as a child that that's something that happened a lot more often when you were too cold. And that it was not, that it was frankly easy to pop your finger off like a block of ice. But that's not Eugene Levy's fault. That's something that, I watched this movie without the proper context.
I also think something that's a lot harder to do is push a cabin. I think two people would struggle to slide a cabin from a half dozen wolves. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's like maybe a little
with that
like
attitude.
Ice...
They would.
It's like a little ice fishing. It's like a little ice fishing cabin, though, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's not that hard.
God damn it.
It's not like easy, but like you could do it if you were sufficiently motivated.
If you were gonna be attacked by wolves. You mentioned whimsy though, and like how it's not really fun. And I think like you kind of want, I do feel like John Ritter should be having more fun than he is with the situation he's in. And he kind of gets at that when he's in the film noir. He's a little bit excited about it. Yep. But it feels like the Chuck Jones segment is the only time when like they're really enjoying themselves at all and kind of having fun with the concept, because they say that they can't be injured and they're like, oh no, we can be injured. But also like clearly they can't because they're repeatedly injured and it's fine. But they're having fun. He eats a lot of donuts. She gets to have pictures of her kids as mice, which is like an amazing gag. And that's like a fun segment. So
it is a fun segment. Yeah. I do think that you make a really good point, Lewis, that like it does feel a little hamstrung. Our two leads feel that way. As kooky as their surroundings are and their circumstances are, they don't feel particularly energized, if that makes sense. And I understand their lives are in danger and I know they should be scared, but also I feel like we don't see Roy's love of television manifest as much as it could. Like, that should be an asset to them, that he knows how to do all these things and that he's excited to do these things or whatever. But instead, it sort of feels like it doesn't really know how to do that. It's odd.
We need them to go on a grand adventure, and they're just kind of randomly getting tugged from place to place. Totally. Like, there needs to be some, like, when John Ritter goes back in, when Roy goes back, I'm sorry, I forgot the name of one of the cinema's finest characters.
Yeah.
When Roy goes back in to save Helen, mm-hmm. then the movie has like stakes and has like a drive, and there's like 10 minutes left, you know,
what I'm hearing is you wanted the movie to be half longer. An hour longer.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
2 hour movie.
I want this to be a 13-episode limited series on AMC. I got some pitches. AMC, call me.
AMC's doing Max Headroom, aren't they?
I think so. We can also reboot Switch for today. I'm working today.
Yeah. I have to ask, what did Libby think of Stay Tuned, Emily?
She didn't watch much of it. Okay. She came in during the cartoon and was like, oh, this seems like it might be okay. And then she was sitting out in the other room with our baby and hearing it.
Yeah.
And because the baby now watches screens. So we are very much like, well, we don't want the baby seeing things that like, and I was like, I don't know if I want my child seeing Stay Tuned. I don't know if I want that being a movie that they're exposed to. But Libby came in, saw the cartoon, was like, this seems fun. And then she was sitting out there and she heard it. And I came out and I was like, you know, it wasn't that great. And she was like, it sounded awful. And I was like,
but I would argue that it should sound more awful, that a more fun version of this would sound like, you know, we'd have more sound effects, we'd have more chaos. It's like, it's both like frenetic and it's pacing and also like a little slow and a little drab and dull. And I think there's a version of this that is like annoying, but like more entertaining overall, because it commits to it and it really goes, you know, it goes through all the channels and has fun with whatever concepts there.
I had a pitch that I went out with years ago.
Stay Tuned?
Kind of was. It was called Technicolor. And it was movies, not television shows. But it was essentially each week our family was pulled into another movie that they had to essentially solve something within that movie in order to get to the next movie. And it was sort of this, you know, fantasy thing, a family adventure type thing. And I think that there's, as I said earlier, like the affinity and the desire to want to sort of, you know, dig into genre and dig it into all the various things that exist in television and movies and all that is enticing. I mean, not just on an IP level, fuck that. I just mean like in general, I think that there's a lot of fun to be had with the multimedium niche-ness of this. I just don't know that they fully capitalize on it with this film, but it certainly is something interesting to it.
You said IP, and I'm just now thinking of a Netflix version of this where it's all Netflix shows and movies, and I can't think of anything more hellish than that.
How far away are we from Netflix just going like full Nintendo and doing like Netflix Kart, Netflix Party, Netflix Tennis, and just like the stars of Netflix driving carts?
Ever since I saw Free Guy, is that the movie that came out? I realized it was all over when he starts fighting with there's a lightsaber and there's some superheroes, and I was like, it's done. Everything's a theme park, and Netflix will certainly have their own version.
Warner Brothers has a Super Smash Brothers game where you can fight as various, and it includes like Arya Stark and Bugs Bunny, and you're like, sure, why not? Sounds great. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like this Super Mario Brothers movie that's coming out in a few weeks is going to be enormous. I imagine it's going to make a boatload of money, which is going to open up the whole like Nintendo universe. And I mean, yeah, we're there. We're definitely going to be like doing all that shit.
I do feel like a lot of people have tried to do variations on this. Like I'm thinking about that Netflix show Maniac, which for me didn't quite work, but was trying to do this. And I think what's really hard is like, you kind of want a home base for a story like this. Like that's what they're trying to do with the kids in a weird way. And it's just like, it's so hard because it starts to feel like anybody can be anybody. And like, that's hard. That's hard to do unless you are like Quantum Leap had like an underscoring idea of what it was trying to say about American history. And like, unless you have a really firm concept, it just, and the concept here is like, TV's kind of bad for you. And I think it's it's saying that in a way that feels out of date, even in 1992, because like there's these twin, I'm going to go TV critic for a second. These like twin things that are happening in 1992, which is you've got, this is also the year Bruce Springsteen releases a song 57 channels and nothing on. So you've got this sense that there are more and more and more channels and like less to watch on them, but it's also the early dawn of the, is TV better than the movies era, which sort of, I count as beginning in like, I think it's 1995. There's an EW cover to that effect where they're like, look at all these great shows. Maybe TV's better than the movies, but we're in the very edges of that. You've had Twin Peaks, you have Northern Exposure, The Simpsons, a bunch of these shows that start to be identified with like quote unquote cinematic TV, which I think is kind of diminishing of what's good about TV. So like Stay Tuned is not really aimed at either of those things. Like the easy thing to do would be, we're aiming at the 57 channels thing. We're flipping between different channels, and each, every 5 minutes is a new TV channel parody. It is very much parodying TV of like 1986, which makes sense given Hollywood development cycles, but TV was changing so rapidly at this point and had so much more cultural growing amount of cultural cachet that it just, it, the movie feels like it's pitched at no one and has no satirical target.
I like the idea that you mentioned about him maybe using his like knowledge of TV shows and like genre. Like there's a meta version of this that's more interesting, because the only real takeaway here is that TV is bad. That like TV is the tool of the devil, and that you know, and that it's keeping him from being the man he should be, where he, you know, teaches girls to fence. But it's like there's not really anything beyond that in terms of like social commentary. So I think that it's hard for us to go anywhere with it, because it arrives at this point that I think is just kind of silly, and I don't think the movie even really agrees with, because it won't really commit to it.
I think,
but it's the only thing that it really offers at all.
I think, not to keep pitching ways to fix this movie that came out, you know, 31 years ago, but I really like, I think there would be something to, if Helen similarly had a thing that she sort of was like ensnared by, and then they both worked through their demons within this hellscape, like that's something. If this movie is more about this marriage has foundered because they don't have time for each other anymore because they have these hobbies or whatever, or if she's got TV shows that she watches to make it really fucking hacky and gender essentialist in 90s, you know, she's addicted to soaps, something like that, where they have to use their knowledge of like different TV genres to help each other survive. Like, I think you got something there, and then it's more about the marriage. But instead, we just have kind of an all-purpose satire, but with like a really fucking good Chuck Jones cartoon in the middle. So,
but I also think too that, like, you know, what we're also reacting to generationally is something that's coming in a few years, which is Scream, and sort of the metatextuality angle of it—the idea of characters that are aware of media, aware of TV and movies, and that deconstruction of all of that.
Well, that they know, they specifically that they know the rules in order to survive.
And this doesn't feel, it seems scared of that.
But I would argue that the time they come closest to that is in the Chuck Jones cartoon.
Yes.
When they order a dog, a robot dog, because they understand that is how you survive a cartoon.
Right.
They're playing by the rules of Chuck Jones cartoons. Whereas the rest of it is like, there aren't really any rules that they can kind of use to their advantage.
Well, I mean, there are, they're choosing kind of not to, right? Like there are rules within a film noir detective movie that they could have played into, or a Western, like they could have played into those things and they chose not to. And I think it does it to both characters a disservice, mostly Roy, in terms of like, that should be his quote unquote superpower. And yet he doesn't use it.
There are rules to a Salt and Pepper video you need in order to survive.
Correct. Yes, Emily?
This is another tangent, but I know that Lewis is a huge Scream fan. So you mentioning Scream, when you said, of course, with what we're talking about is Scream, I thought you were going to say the internet. And that made the now freelancing part of my brain ping. Is Scream the first movie about the internet? because it's not actually about the internet, but it feels very grounded in like the way people were starting to talk about pop culture. I think that's an accident. I think it's Kevin Williamson riffing on like what Tarantino was already doing, but there's something very specifically youth friendly and genre friendly and like just really digging into like a specific thing that feels to me like an early internet comment section. I don't know, I think there's something there, and I just want to hear Lewis riff on it because I know you love fucking Scream. Scream 6, so good.
I do love Scream. I think there's something interesting there because, you know, what to me what Scream is doing, if you want to talk about it in a horror context, is taking what Wes Craven did in New Nightmare, which is kind of one of the really early meta horror slashers, and then making it so that it's not just the audience that gets it, it's the characters who are really self-aware, which definitely feels like an internet thing. I mean, you know, I think it's also in that case because they're not really talking about it online, it's like sort of video store culture, and it's like the experts are the people who work at the video store. But certainly the internet is an undercurrent there, and being able to talk about movies the way we did for a time, and now it's, I don't know, it's all chaos, was helpful to kind of figuring out the rules that we're playing by, or when you're watching a movie, kind of like what tropes and what, you know, thematic links it has to other movies. Like, that is something that does feel very internet culture to me. So you should definitely pitch your screen piece.
Listen, I missed the newspeg. I missed the fucking newspeg.
Well, wait till Scream 7, which, you know, will be out, I'm sure, in
2 years from now.
5 minutes. Well, this one came out like Scream 2, like barely a year after the last one. But then traditionally speaking, they wait a couple years for the next one. So that probably seems right.
I gotta say, I really fucking dig the new cast. I know a lot of people don't. I really like them. I really like these new kids.
I liked them a lot more in 6 than in 5.
I would say that Melissa Barrera is much better in 6 than in 5.
Yes. I was probably reading my love of her TV performances onto 5, but like, I agree, she's much better in 6. I also like that she has a boyfriend who's like just kind of doesn't deliver lines very well, and you're like, oh, Sam, get some.
Well, but you've seen the other two, or you've not seen the other two, the television show?
I have seen the other two. I don't think I've seen season two. I've seen season one.
Lance is amazing.
That's the thing about Josh Segarra, is that's just how he talks.
Yeah. Yes.
It's actually a very naturalistic performance, because that is how
he's a weird fit. He's a weird fit in the Scream universe, I think. Whereas like Tim Robinson is a great fit in the Scream universe, even if he's just playing a voice cameo. Perfect. Sure. Perfect.
It's interesting. I went into this one with pretty low expectations because I didn't really love 5.
5's great. It's great.
I wish I liked it more.
I will not stand for the 5 slander, and I'm really upset that everyone has used this. It's fine if you never liked it, but a lot of people that I know liked 5 saw 6 and were like, I love 6. 5 was garbage in retrospect, and I cannot.
I wouldn't say that. Here's what I'll say too. The Scream movies are great. Like, as a franchise, I think they're a great franchise. I'm thrilled that like they found new life, because it seemed like after 4 everyone had kind of just they seemed done with it, and thankfully Paramount and Spyglass saw potential in it and what have you. I just thought that 6 seemed, I think that 5 felt weighted down with expectations a little bit, and I think that 6 felt a little freer since 5 was a success. They could kind of run with things a little bit more with 6. It felt a little bit, I don't know, lighter on its feet.
The one thing I hope is that as they keep making Scream movies, they keep Jasmine Savoy Brown alive so that she has to continue to explain like the complicated way it fits. Like, I want her to be in Scream 8.5, Scream on Mars, and be explaining like what a side quill is to like just like a whole bunch of randos.
I want her to use Halloween Ends to explain how the third movie in a prequel trilogy has to wildly diverge from the story and have a different killer.
Sure.
I think that would be a good next movie for me. I also think, to bring this back to Stay Tuned,
yes, of course,
is that were he not who he is, Jeffrey Jones would be a great ghost face. Unfortunately, yes. There's too much baggage there.
No, he would be a good one.
But he would be a great ghost face.
I agree with that.
Do you think Roger L. Jackson, the voice of Ghostface, modulates his performance based on which killer he's supposedly voicing? I feel like he's that dedicated.
We get like in Scream 5, we get him talking in his like normal voice when he's calling Tara on the phone, and he's like kind of talking like friend from AA. I believe that's him doing just like his actual voice before he gets really growly.
A lot of my love of 5 is a love of that cold open. I think that cold open is one of the best. It's so good. It upends so many expectations.
Jenna Ortega.
He attacks Jenna Ortega. Don't really know who she is. You're like, okay, so they're not doing a famous person. And then she lives. And you're like, oh, she's one of the main. It's so good. Perfect.
I should watch 5 again. I feel like it's going to end up being Blank Check's Patreon. So I feel like I'm just going to kind of wait and see if it wins the bracket this year.
Scream podcast now. We're just talking Scream.
It's not unrelated. I mean, I was thinking about it too, because I think that this is a movie that like tries to do meta and fails at it.
Yes.
Or barely tries to do meta, but you know, I think we all agree there's a version of this that's so much more interesting that would really like lean into the meta.
Do you think that this movie, as a child, Lewis, teed you up for your love of Scream? Like that it broke your brain just enough so that
I will say that it did, not because of the meta, but because I think as a kid who was really scared of like horror movies, it was watching movies like this that made me, you know, later come to rediscover them and be able to watch them. Perfect. It was like growing up with this, the aforementioned Gremlins 2, like movies that are scary, like, but that taught me that like horror can be fun, I think were really formative. So yes, it brought me to Scream.
Let's rate this, because I'd love to hear your thoughts on what we're covering next week, Lewis. So I, as I mentioned, had not seen this film in 92. I came into this podcast, I think I was perhaps a little too generous. I came in at a 70, which I think is a little...
Emily's face is really good.
Perfect. I'm going down, Emily. It's not like I'm staying at 70. I'm going down to a 59. I think that this movie is a little bit of a missed opportunity. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. As I mentioned, there's some great performances, some great jokes. I'm just not sure that it all fully comes together. But when I stopped watching it yesterday, I was like, that movie was kind of fun. And now with us unpacking it, I've come back down to earth.
We've talked you out of having a good opinion of it.
So where are you, Lewis? Where were you when you saw this as a kid, and where are you now?
Well, as a kid, this was a perfect score.
99.
Watching it again was a trip, because I don't remember when I last saw it. I've seen it as an adult, but it's been years. I truly remember every line of this movie, every line reading. I knew what was happening next. I knew it was really kind of weird how well I remembered it, memorized it. So I feel like I can't rate it properly. I didn't rate it on Letterboxd. I said that I couldn't rate it. and someone commented and said, this movie is also a 1.5-star/4-star movie to me. And I was like, maybe I average those. Maybe I'm like, you know, it's kind of like, it's like, I don't know. It's like a 50, which is not an average, but I'm not doing the math right now, where it's just like, it's perfect and terrible at the same time. It's right in the middle.
What about you, Emily? I'm very curious to hear this.
The conversation drifted past this so quickly, I didn't get a chance to talk about this, but I have had stuck in my head ever since we discussed this an image of like a group of like trans people outside the 1992 Oscars protesting the Crying Game. And then across the street, one man with 3 billboards, the first of which reads, stay tuned, groundbreaking digital effects. Second one reads, and yet no special effects nomination. Third one reads, how come Academy? I just have this image in my brain of him like lonely picketing.
And that's
Academy
what Martin, and that's what Martin McDonagh saw. And inspired his movie. Incredible.
A young Martin McDonagh sees this on television. It's like,
oh, incredible.
First, I'm doing 90 queer phobia scale. I'm going to give this a 6. Not overtly queer phobic, but literally every joke in it that could approach queer phobia, you're like, oh, they're assuming I'm laughing at these guys being sort of soft with each other because I'm like laughing at the presumption of some sort of feminine.
What do you think of that
sexual stereotype?
The queer phobia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the queer phobia scale of 0 to 10.
I was surprised, pleasantly surprised that the French Revolution stuff was like less transphobic than it could have been, which is a very low bar, but I was like, I think the movie, and I'm always pleasantly surprised when I watch a movie from the early 90s that doesn't make me feel disgusting. That seems fair to me.
I definitely felt like the scenes with the French Revolution were like A, less transphobic than they could have been, but B, because they were assuming I was bringing a transphobic read to it. Like, they didn't need to be like, ha ha ha, John Ritter is wearing a dress and that makes him, you know, whatever slur you want to throw at him, because they just assumed that my brain was already going there, especially with the gag that takes us out of that moment, where somebody's like, hey, I wear women's clothing too. And then the other guy looks at him like, bleh!
That's right. I was trying to remember. There was one joke in there that I was like, sad trombone. Yeah. And it was that one.
And like, I'm being a little bit harsh on it in this regard, but I think that I never saw this when it came out. I desperately wanted to as a stand-dauber. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see it in theaters, but it got a very limited release, didn't come anywhere near me. So I never got to see it, and I just never watched it because it didn't have a great reputation. But I gave the trailers I gave a blurb. I read about it in the newspaper in 99 in 1992. I thought that was sounded like the best movie ever made. Now, I came in being like, this is a straight down the middle 50, right between like the bad and good, just like right in the middle. Like, I can't recommend it one way or the other. Then I remembered I'm taking 2 points off for the driving over Miss Daisy joke. So it's going down to a 48 because that joke was very bad. And thus I narrowly do not recommend watching this at all.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe what you have to understand about the driving over Miss Daisy joke is that there was a movie called Driving Miss Daisy. So that's like kind of the context for it. And then driving over an old person is inherently funny. So they just kind of, that's where they were going with it. But it's a little, it's heady. I understand it's not for everyone.
So next week, we are doing a very rare thing on this podcast, which is a double bill. We have Karina Longworth coming on to talk about Basic Instinct and Consenting Adults, which obviously matches up with her erotic 90s miniseries that she is embarking on. So she came on to talk about the third highest grossing film of 1992, Basic Instinct, and everyone's favorite Consenting Adults, the movie where Kevin Kline is accused and convicted of murdering someone who it's a whole thing. But Kevin Spacey's in it.
Great.
It's a great episode. I had a blast talking about both of these films. I think you did too, Emily, right? You talked to you had a good time talking Basic Instinct and Consenting Adults.
Oh, listen, I consent adult all the time. I had a blast talking about the Kevins and their homoerotic passion.
Yes. That had a pretty, if I remember correctly, on the queer phobia scale for that one, you had an interesting take. I am curious, Lewis, do you have thoughts on Basic Instinct?
Never seen it.
Really?
Never seen it. I feel like there's a whole, I was thinking about this because I'm excited for that podcast or the season. Of
yes. You must
and then
remember
I
this.
Saw, yes. And I saw Criterion is doing
just announced it today.
Erotic thrillers. There's like so much I haven't seen that I need to catch up on. I was busy watching Stay Tuned 500 times. Not that I should have been Basic Instinct as like a 6-year old, but I've never seen it. I am.
It's pretty fun.
I think I'm going to like dive into erotic thrillers soon, unless I can like keep badgering Clay to give me another like project to work on for Screen Drafts. I'm going to do erotic thrillers for myself, for my own education.
Yeah, I do feel like Screen Drafts is a perfect opportunity to do deep dives into things. I agree with you on that. Erotic 90s stuff. Like, I saw a handful of them, but obviously Karina's doing a deep, deep dive and there's a bunch that I want to catch up on. So yeah, if our listeners do not subscribe to Criterion Channel, this would be a good month to do it because there's a bunch of really great stuff on there. And Karina's the best. It was a blast talking Sharon Stone and fucking Michael Douglas.
Sharon Stone referenced in Scream very memorably. Yeah, you don't remember?
I don't think I do.
About when they're saying that Sydney's mom was...
Oh, sure.
Like strutting around like Sharon Stone, and she was no Sharon Stone. There's another Sharon Stone thing earlier in the movie that I can't remember right now, she definitely should be Ghostface next, since Jeffrey Jones is out of the picture.
I will say this, and we talked about this, Emily, a little bit on the episode when we talked about Basic Instinct, but... what I do think you would appreciate, Lewis, and would enjoy is, like, it's a really well-made movie. Like, Paul Verhoeven is obviously a great filmmaker. So, like, and it's shot by Jan de Bont, who would go on to do Speed and Twister. Like, the movie is just really slick and fun, and the car chases are cool. Like, it's one of those things where, like, if you take out all the, like, you know, sex stuff, which is obviously part of why the film does as well as it does, so much of it is rooted in, like, an action movie. It's and gory, like it's bloody as
well. But if I want to watch a lesbian kill people,
yeah,
is that the right movie for me?
I don't know, Emily. What would you say to that?
By the way, I do want to watch a lesbian kill people. I hope that was I appreciate movies.
I'm not gonna kill people. I'm not gonna spoil my queer phobia rating for Basic Instinct, but it's my favorite one I've given yet. Yeah. I'm gonna say this: that movie is so afraid of lesbians that it passes through some event horizon and becomes like one of the most positive representations of lesbians I've ever seen.
No, I mean, I completely get that. I mean, I feel that way. Like, I love Cruising, a movie that people wrongly consider to be homophobic, but is actually super pro gay in my opinion. I'm going to watch Basic Instinct from a like lesbian superhero perspective.
That's probably the right way to look at it.
Yeah, of all of it. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But more than anything, where can people find you? And is there anything that you want to plug?
They can find me on Twitter at Lewis Peitzman, on Letterboxd, same name. Nothing to plug. Nothing at all. I don't have a lot going on. That's why I'm like, I need a project.
No, I didn't mean it like that.
That's why I pitch myself to podcasts.
Please.
Hit me up for a podcast appearance, and around.
Believe me, now that I know that, I'm hitting you up way more for this. But we'd love to have you back, obviously.
We gotta fucking do Mom and Dad Save the World. I gotta see that movie.
I feel like that's now, yeah,
is
for
that,
sure.
Is it available anywhere? I want to make sure that it's... like
I'm sure it's on YouTube, but I don't know if I'm like, it must be. I do have it on DVD if you want. Next
it is on HBO Max currently.
Okay,
so
okay, yeah. I was gonna say, next time I'm in the area,
I never thought I'd say this, but thank you, David Zaslav, for
be careful what you wish for, because that he could pull it by the end of the day.
You think we could fucking pitch around a Mom and Dad Save the World show? Let's try it. Let's take it out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lewis. This was absolutely a blast. And we obviously are going to have you back to talk about how the titular mother and father saved the world. So we can't wait for that.
Thanks for having me. It was super fun.
Thank you so much, Lewis. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.